This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories. Our podcast is recorded in La Truita, home of the Palawa people. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country, their diversity, histories and knowledge, and their continuing connections to land and community. We also acknowledge LGBTIQA+ advocates, friends and allies whose courage and strengths have helped to make this a more just society for lesbian, gay, bisexual, gender diverse and intersex populations and their families.
I'm Jack Ritchie. I go by he, him pronouns, most of the time anyway. I do drag, so when I'm in drag, I like to be she, her. I would consider myself pansexual, though pretty mostly openly a gay man, and people see me that way. So I was born and raised in Cairns, up in Far North Queensland, and my parents got a divorce when I was two, and my mum moved on and met my stepdad, and I was mostly raised by them, but I saw my real dad on the weekends. And my parents created and ran their own business, which was a boat that took tourists out to the reef. And it became a family business, and I worked for them, and my brothers worked for them. My brothers still work up there on the boats. And my dad is a psychologist, my real dad. And Cairns was an interesting place to grow up. Definitely a different perspective, definitely very different from Tasmania. Mm-hmm. It's obviously in climate, but yeah, in a lot of ways. And so I've always got like a bit of the ocean in my blood, I guess. I have two brothers. I'm the middle child. Definitely had a bit of middle child syndrome. I was a very sensitive kid and knew from a very young age that I was very different from other kids. My parents weren't really all that accepting of me being different, I feel. And yeah, definitely there was, like there is throughout Australia, throughout rural Australia, there was definitely like a sort of hyper-masculine or heteronormative kind of way that you're supposed to be. And that was definitely drilled into me as a kid. And I was often told that I was being too sensitive or that I should do more boyish things and yeah, all that sort of stuff. So that was definitely really hard. I had an experimental experience with another boy at quite a young age, and that became a really big kind of shame event for me. That was when I was nine. And the shame was so much I couldn't tell anyone. And the only thing I could tell people was how upset I was and never really explain why. And yeah, I was suicidal at that age, actually, which was strange. And my teacher thought that I was getting abused at home because I was so upset, but they couldn't really figure out what was going on with me because I wouldn't really tell anyone. And yeah, I didn't really properly come out, I guess, to myself until I was about 14. And yeah, that was kind of my early childhood.
What was school like in general?
Yeah, I was a really sensitive kid, and I had friends all through both primary school and high school, tend to hang out with girls more, and that rumors started that I was gay because of that as well. But I had some really, really good close friends, but I also was bullied by like the popular guys, the sporty guys. I really hated anything athletic or sporty. I just felt like I couldn't keep up. I was always a chunky kid as well. And I was teased for that as well, which was hard. But yeah, as I said, my parents really pushed me to grow up to be a man and be masculine. And they really wanted me to be into sports and all that stuff. And it just wasn't me.
It was your family kind of sporty? Were your siblings kind of sporty? Were they trying to make you fit in with them, or was it extra? My experience was kind of similar. My dad was very pushy into, let's sit down and watch football, even though I knew he hated football. So my family wasn't involved in that sort of thing, but because I think they had a sense that I wasn't going to fit that mold that they were expecting, that they sort of pushed this extra thing to me.
Yeah, I think that was the same case. My parents weren't particularly sporty. My stepdad watched a lot of cricket. My dad was more of an intellectual kind of bookish person. But mum was the one who would really push that we all played sport. I think we were all kind of overweight as kids, and I think that was part of it. But also, my mum and my stepdad were so busy running their business, they didn't get, like, they'd both be at work until pretty late, so I think they just wanted us to be busy doing extracurricular things and not just sitting around or, you know, breaking things in the house. Yeah.
Was there much of a queer influence in your life around then? Did you have any queer family members, or do you remember anything from the media really standing out?
No queer family members, and I don't really remember who the first queer person that I knew was. But my dad was really into prog rock and like 1970s music, and I got really interested in David Bowie and because of his influence, and also dad was really into art, and he told me about Andy Warhol, and I got really obsessed with Andy Warhol. I remember we as a family went on a trip somewhere, I think it was to the Gold Coast, but we also went to Brisbane, and at the Brisbane Art Museum there was an Andy Warhol exhibit, and it was like such a formative memory for me, and my mum could tell how obsessed I was with it, and then they sort of saw me as this artist, and that kind of was great because I am a creative person, and it helped me kind of turn it become who I was, you know. Yeah, and to have those kind of queer heroes as well as I kind of grew into myself as a queer person was really great. It was really helpful to sort of know their lives and sort of see myself in them.
What age were you around that time?
I was probably about 12 when I first started getting into like David Bowie and Eddie Wall. Yeah, 12 to 14, that sort of, yeah.
Is that when you were kind of reconciling your sexuality and kind of accepting it as well? Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I think throughout primary school, when I was bullied, I would complain to the teachers or whatever. And I remember sort of being so excited to go to high school because I'd be going to a different high school. I'd be able to reintroduce myself to the people around me. And I was like hopeful that people wouldn't kind of typecast me as like the chunky effeminate guy that no one wanted to be friends with. And then I was really passionate with my studies in the first year of high school, which got me labeled as like a nerd. And then I just rejected all of the identity that was put on me in year nine, like the second year of high school. And I just was like, no, this is who I am. I am a gay person. That's part of who I was. And there was a sense of rebellion in that. I was at a Catholic high school. I knew that it would be an outrageous thing to be openly queer, and it was. It was very, very controversial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were open at high school?
I was, but not to my parents, not at home, just at school with my friends, and yeah.
Did the school do anything or say anything?
Not at first. I don't think they got back to the teachers for a while. When it eventually did, the school deacon took me aside and like took me out of class and was questioning me about what I was doing and why I was telling people that I was gay, and he was asking about my early childhood and kind of letting me know, oh, you're not gay, but you've just had some trauma that's making you think that you are, and sort of trying to talk me out of it. And this is around the same time that I started hooking up with men. I would it was before Grindr that there was on one of my early mobile phones, there was like a way to chat with men online, and I would sneak out and go and meet men and hook up with them, which looking back now, I'm like, I was a kid, that's so wrong and really gross. But at the time I didn't see it that way. And I, eventually confided in one of the, I think it was the deacon, it was a different teacher in school, but it got back to him and he was fairly understandably pretty concerned. And he went to my year coordinator, who went to someone in the diocese, and they all wanted to talk to me about it. And they were going to talk to my parents about it and find out who this guy that I'd hooked up with was and all the rest of it. And I just had to turn around and deny the story. I just said, oh, I just made it all up. And even though it was true, but I just was the only way I could kind of get myself out of this trouble was to say that it was all a lie. And yeah, and it did, it worked. I got away with it. But it was very scary for a minute there. Yeah.
Did that leave you with a sense of like having to hide that part of yourself moving forward as well, do you think?
I think it just, I knew that I had to hide it from my parents already. I think it just made me more rebellious. It just made me more angry at the world and more wanting to do sex, drugs, and rock and roll. and you know, and I also had that basis of like David Bowie as my idol. So I definitely, yeah, had this idea that I rejected being told that I was a fat nerd and then decided, no, I'm actually a gay rock star. And so, yeah, I just was like, oh, I'll just do whatever it is that I think is cool. And that's what I've kind of chased through my early life. After high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do tertiary education wise or anything. My parents were really adamant that I should do some kind of tertiary education. So I think I had a couple of gap years and I was working for the family business out on the boats, which was great. I was making a lot of money doing that, but it's like 10-hour days in the sun and I wasn't healthy. I was smoking and overweight. I started smoking a lot of weed and that was a big problem. I also got into a really kind of toxically close relationship with my best friend from high school. I was still so wrapped up in all of the anti-gay stuff that was, I guess, around me and put on me as a kid that I really wasn't fully accepting of who I was still at that time. And I went through some really depressive periods of just being a total stoner who hated himself and would hook up with people and stuff, but wouldn't ever really have a serious relationship with anyone because I think I was so tied to my best friend. And yeah, that was a hard few years. And around that time, I got diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And I went through a lot of therapy with that. I did dialectical behavior therapy. And that was really full on. yeah.
Did the DBT help?
I think yes, it helped somewhat. It's something I still struggle with. I have a borderline mind in a lot of ways, and I find it really hard to regulate my emotions. And I have a really strong sense of justice. And if I think something's wrong, I really feel it to my core. And it can be really hard, especially in a workplace, and especially like navigating social situations. It's, yeah, can be very difficult. And then I studied fashion. My mom, I was really into fashion throughout life. And my mom was like, well, why don't you go do this? And it was available at TAFE. So I did a year in Cairns at TAFE. And then followed that up with a year in Brisbane at TAFE to get my diploma. Learned to sew and pattern make and all the rest of it. And it was pretty inspired, and I had a lot of ideas and had a great time studying and making clothes and stuff, and I still sew and I love that I have those skills. But I did find it was really like, unless you had some kind of huge investor or something, like a big amount of capital, it would be so hard to start your own brand and then to break into the industry working under someone else. It's so difficult, especially when a lot of the skills that you learn are practical skills that aren't really used in the fashion industry within Australia because everything's outsourced. Mm-hmm. So it's just, yeah, it was really difficult. I mean, I could be a dressmaker or a bridal dressmaker or something like that, but it wasn't what I was passionate about. I was, you know, wanted to push the boundaries of fashion as a creative young gay person would. So I found that it didn't really lead to much after that. And I kind of found myself back in Cairns and back in the same sort of depressive lifestyle of just being a stoner and not really hoping for much. And still at that time, having a lot of internalized homophobia and and those sort of things going on with me. And then my mom was sort of like, you need to sort of snap out of this. Like, you need to do something else with your life because you're not going anywhere. So I got a working visa and I moved to London for 2.5 years. And that was where I really came into myself as a queer person and found queer community and started drag and, yeah, kind of really found out who I was. So that was amazing.
Yeah. So what led to London and what were you doing while you were there?
Well, my family on my mum's side are from England. And I think they were toying with the idea of me getting dual citizenship. So I think that's where the idea first came from, because my nana at that time wasn't fully naturalized as an Australian. I think she still had a British citizenship. So we thought we could do that. We couldn't, but I could get a working visa. And there was some family friend who had a spare room that could put me up for a time. So it just sort of worked out. And I, before I went, I was chefing in Cairns. So I got a job as a chef at a pub in London, which I hated. Being a chef is awful and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And I met heaps of people and stuff. I don't know that I really had much of a goal going there. I had traveled before, like for my 21st, my mum got me a Contiki tour of Europe. So I had gone to London and sort of seen what it was like there. And I guess that was excited to be in a big city, a world city, and be around the cutting edge of fashion and also gay community. Like, I knew that there was a huge gay community, lots of parties, opportunities to meet people, which, yeah, when I could afford to do stuff like that, I would, which was really good at first. And then I kind of, I think the reality of how expensive to live there set in, and struggled to kind of survive for a time. And then I shacked up with a guy who I met who was not a good person, or at least had a lot of stuff to work out. He was like, I mean, it was in London, but at the time it was like, I think during Trump's first election or whatever. And my boyfriend at the time was pro-Trump and was quite conservative, which is insane. But yeah, and I was just an idiot. So I just went along with whatever. And I was just happy to have someone who wanted me. And really, I had a crush on his housemate, who was not someone I should have had a crush on, because he was all up in the chemsex scene, which I eventually kind of got wrapped up in as well. I lost my job, or I think I quit because I just couldn't handle it anymore. And I was unemployed for a time, and then I moved out of my house, moved into this room that my boyfriend had. And just would go from chemsex party to chemsex party while he was at work, and I would be doing smoking meth and doing GHB and MCAT and whatever else I could get my hands on. And eventually I overdosed on GHB in the middle of the day in some random borough of London that I didn't even know where I was. And yeah, this guy who I was at his house hooking up with, who fed me all the GHB, just kicked me out because his wife was coming home. And I just was ODing on the street, which was really scary. And I pissed myself and it was gross. And this lovely Muslim lady came and saved me. Like, I know she's Muslim because she had a headscarf. And I just had this vision of her, like, reaching down to me in the gutter, like Mary, the Virgin Mary, kind of saving my life. It was a weird kind of religious experience. But yeah, and then after that, I sort of was like, okay, I need to clean up my act a bit and stop doing those nasty drugs. So I just did nice drugs like coke. I kind of rebuilt after that and got another job. I worked at a trampoline park, which was really fun. And met a lovely guy who I shacked up with after that. And he and I were going really steady and really serious up until my visa ran out and I couldn't work anymore. I stayed as long as I could. And the plan was he was going to save up money and come and live in Australia for a while and meet my family. I had met his family and everything, and it all seemed like it was all going ahead. I had to move back to Australia, and I thought he would follow me, but he decided not to. He moved back to his hometown in the Midlands, somewhere in England, and I think he just found the prospect of moving countries too scary, ultimately. And the Brits, they're so afraid of Australia, they think everything here is going to kill you, which is a little bit true, but...
Also, they did send all their criminals here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that was London adventure.
Yeah.
And then back to Australia and back to not knowing what to do with myself. And my mum again was like, okay, what now? And while I was in London, I got into drag and was really into that and came back to living in Cairns and started doing drag in Cairns while I was just working at KFC. And that was such a fun time because Cairns has such a cool nightlife with all the backpackers. There's actually quite a few nightclubs. And when I was 18 and stuff, I used to go out and get on the piss. But this time I was doing it in drag. And I feel like at that time they hadn't seen kind of modern drag race kind of drag before. So they'd only ever seen like the chunky old femme queens. They hadn't seen someone who was like trying to serve sexy. And I really was serving sexy, and I turned a lot of heads, and it was really exciting time for me, and I had so much fun. So I knew that I wanted to do something with that, and then I had to come out to my parents as a drag queen after having already come out as gay. So that was pretty full on.
When did you tell them that you were gay?
Yeah, I glossed over that, sorry.
Yeah.
So what happened was I was out from 14 in high school.
Yeah.
And then there was a few times where I sort of let it slip to my mom and she rejected it out of hand. Like I would say, oh, these kids at school are bullying me or something. And she'd say, well, why are they bullying you? Or what are they saying? And I'd say, oh, they're saying that I'm gay. And well, why are they saying that? Because I am. No, you're not. You know what I mean? It was like that. And end of conversation. And then it was free dress day, I think, in year 12. And I was an arty student, so I had access to the art room and everything. And I had screen printed my own t-shirt that said, my mom gay. And I wore it to school on free dress day. And they were furious. And they made me take it off. And my school was St. Mary's. And I had screen printed another t-shirt, which I was wearing underneath, that said, St. Mary's, I'm straight. Which made them even more furious when I revealed. I did a reveal in high school. Of course I was going to be a drag queen. And yeah, so they called my mom. And then I came home from school that day and she was sitting on my bed, just weeping, just beside herself. And going through that mourning, you know, she was mourning the loss of her child. Like in a way, she really had this idea of what my life would look like. And that was shattered. And she was just like, how am I gonna like know you anymore? It felt like she didn't know me, which was pretty upsetting for me as well. But
yeah.
We moved on and we got there eventually.
Back from London, you got into drag in Queensland, and then what was next?
And then Mum said, you look amazing in drag. You're really good at makeup. You should be a makeup artist. And I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. But I really loved makeup. And I would, you know, makeup YouTube tutorials were the big thing at that time. Mm-hmm. So I thought I could do that maybe, which is ridiculous because I might be cute in drag, but I'm not that cute. I'm still a man with big pores and everything else. But anyway, we looked at different makeup schools and there was one on the Gold Coast that was advertising itself as the best makeup school in the Southern Hemisphere. And it was going to be ways like it could help you get into the movie industry, like doing movie makeup. So I jumped on that. I was able to get a hex set to go and do that because it was through TAFE, but it was still a private makeup school. And it's called Huxley's School of Makeup. So I moved to the Gold Coast and I did that and it was good. I did lots of work experience makeup jobs for music videos. I was on the set helping organize extras for Baz Luhrmann's Elvis movie at Village Roadshow, which was pretty cool. But I wasn't paid. It was really hard to get paid gigs doing that kind of work on the Gold Coast because there were so many makeup schools on the Gold Coast and they're all pumping out students who are willing to do work experience jobs for free. And then there's freelance makeup, which you could do. And I did that a little bit. And I still do that a little bit, like for girls' formals, maybe even bridal, stuff like that, which you can, if you really like hustle, you can make money doing that. But I still kind of struggle to sell myself in a way and to manage myself. So it just wasn't feasible to like do that full time. So I needed to work. So that's when I started working at Kmart. I met my current partner on the Gold Coast and he is a pharmacist and he and I loved living on the Gold Coast and kind of slowly got involved in the gay scene. The gay scene on the Gold Coast, or at least at that time, was a little bit cliquey and wasn't a gay bar at all when we first met. And then I think maybe 6 months into our relationship, this bar called Chameleon opened up in Broadbeach. And we started going there fairly regularly. And we kind of got known as regulars there, which was really fun. I started going in drag there. There was always drag shows, but I was never asked to perform. Like the other queens would come up and be like, oh my God, your hair and your makeup and everything, like you look amazing. But they would never kind of go, oh, here's an opportunity, you know? And I was like, oh, like I wish they would, but I get it because I really didn't have much performance experience. Like when I was doing drag in London, I was just going out and getting on drugs. It wasn't actually like working. And in Cairns, I'd only performed once or twice. It was mostly just going out partying. So, yeah, I was like, okay, this is like a hobby for me, or I don't really understand what it was. And then the COVID happened and shut down the Gold Coast. And that was pretty full on. And my partner was working at a chemist warehouse and, you know, he was still early in his pharmacy career, but he hated working for them because they're really like, you know, bottom line focused and, you know, yeah. So he was looking online for different positions and had gone on a holiday to Tasmania before and said how amazing it was. And said, he found this job that was advertised, in Exeter at the Terry White, and it was paying way more than he was earning already for the same, an easier job. Actually, he was a pharmacist manager and it was just a regular pharmacy job. So it was, yeah, really a great opportunity. And with COVID, everyone moving to the Gold Coast was making rental prices increase and much harder to find rentals. So we were kind of stuck in this place that we didn't really like as well. And we were looking at places down here and you could afford what looked like mansions to us for the same price. So we were just like, yeah, let's do it.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's moved so many times. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I intend to keep moving so many times. Maybe not. I really like it here. I have found a great amount of queer community here and I've been working in drag here. And yeah, so really, and Bailey, my partner Bailey, is really happy here. So yeah.
Yeah, great.
So when we first moved here, Bailey, my partner, moved here a couple of weeks before I did to suss out the place. And I think he was getting started at the job straight away. And during that time, he was like on the apps, on Grindr, hooking up with people. We've always kind of been in an open relationship. And also just being like, I'm new in town, I'd love to meet people. And there were a few people that came forward and introduced themselves. There's this one guy, he doesn't live here anymore, unfortunately, called Craig, who was very involved in the community, and he'd done, or was in the process of doing some kind of gender studies course. So he was very like woke, and which definitely appealed to me. And he introduced us to a bunch of people. There was another guy who is still here, Rick Shegog, who invited us to one of his parties he often hosts, where he invites lots of local gay guys. So Bailey went to those sort of parties and met a lot of people that way. And then I came down and was introduced to the people he'd met, and we all just started hanging out. And then from there, Craig introduced us to Grace, who doesn't live here anymore also, fortunately, but her mum owns the Royal Oak, and she was organizing the events for the Royal Oak, including Mood, which is a queer party up here, and like booking the drag queens for it and everything. And I sort of said, hey, I do drag and I want to be involved, and we would go to the Mood parties and be big supporters of it. And I would always go in drag in a costume. It was always a costume competition, and I won a couple of times. And often Grace and other people involved would say, like, you need to be up on stage, not just in the costume contest. Like, your costumes are that good, you need to be showing it off better. And I was like, okay. So then I started doing that. And last year sometime, in June, she had gone over to Melbourne and wasn't going to be around to organize the next Mood party. So my partner and I put our hand up and organized it ourselves. And that was Mood Goes Pop. It's kind of a full circle moment because it was inspired by like pop art, like Andy Warhol, and also just pop culture. So yeah, we met heaps of people, a lot of other drag queens and stuff that way. And that's kind of been our evolving group. We've met other couples and we go to a trivia. There was one last night at Tandy's, which was drag trivia. I think it's still drag trivia. It's changed hosts a couple times. And yeah, whenever I see someone new in town on Grindr or whatever, I always reach out and say, hey, how you going? Like, would you like to come to this trivia thing? There's always gay guys that go, or trans people or queer people. Or, yeah, it's a great way to meet people. And everyone who goes to that trivia is really friendly. And yeah, it's been a great way to meet people and make new friends.
The marriage equality plebiscite.
Oh, yeah.
Where were you when that happened?
I was actually living in London that time, but I came home to Australia for a family holiday, like to visit my family, and was able to vote in it while I was here. So I was very excited. I was very like it was surreal to come to Australia and have it all over the news and be such an issue when I'd been living in totally a different part of the world and not really knowing that this was happening. Mm. And to come here and see that people were so open about talking about their opinions about it was really like shocking. and yeah, I was surprised. And much like the recent vote, I was surprised at how kind of the audacity that people would open their mouth and say such things. It was just, yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was pretty triggering, but I was so excited to see that it was, obviously Australia voted in support. So yeah.
After we had that victory, there was a bit of a pushback about the religious freedoms bill.
Right. I'm aware that still today there are communities that think that way, and like what's happened in Sydney recently is, yeah, it's pretty atrocious with the book banning. That's the world we live in, unfortunately. I try to like not get too wrapped up in it because I went down a rabbit hole of getting really into the culture war stuff on YouTube or the internet in general, and it just made me miserable to look at. And I always thought I was, like, I don't watch the news because I would always watch my stepdad watch the news every night and like yell at the TV his opinions. And I just thought, I don't need to be brought into this negativity. I want to choose what I, is brought into my life. So I was always like, oh, I just won't watch TV. I'll just look at what I want to look at. But the way the algorithm works, you get fed. Like, if you look at anything like gay or trans related, you'll get pushed anti-gay and anti-trans stuff as well, and that would just get my goat, and I'd end up engaging with that content, which would just push it more, and it just became really toxic. And I was like, oh, this is not helpful. And yeah, there are these parasitical people that make their money just with fear, and it's awful. It's really awful.
Have you noticed a big shift in community acceptance of queer people from when you were young to now?
Yeah, I think it's weird. I can't kind of divorce my own like internalized homophobia experience from reality. Like, you know, over we can only see our own perspective. But I do remember when I would go out clubbing when I was like 18, 19 in Cairns, I would still like dress up and do a little bit of makeup and stuff. I wasn't in drag, but I would still be obviously gay, obviously queer, and I would get attacked by people. And then when I came back and started going out in drag, it was like the opposite. It was, I felt like a celebrity. People would run up to me and want to take photos with me. Like, yeah, there might've been some really concerned looks or like some guys that would just open mouth stare at me from across the room, but it wasn't like as aggressive. And I wondered if the plebiscite, like people knowing the results of that, had shifted public like idea of what's acceptable, how to act in those sort of settings, or maybe it was just the power of drag, the fact that I was sort of emulating a female or a feminine energy rather than being like a gay man. Maybe the idea of a trans woman or a drag queen was more acceptable to these men. I don't know, it's a strange thing. And you know, I know that Tasmania and Launceston and this area particularly is known for being one of the most homophobic places in Australia, and that was definitely a concern when I was moving here. But I guess I sort of saw it as a challenge. And yeah, and there are really homophobic people here, but they tend to be the most bogan, the most gronky, you know? So yeah, I feel like they just need to work out their own, like looking after themselves more than anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's next for you and Bailey?
I don't know. We're gonna keep on keeping on in Lonnie. We're gonna keep on keeping on with Mood. The next Mood is Medieval Mood. We're not gonna be there for that one. For the one following it, I don't know if I can give too much away, but we're gonna be involved in that, and yeah, it'll be very exciting. I do want to plug Mood as something for young queer people to go to. I think they're looking at creating like an underage Mood as well for even younger queer people, which would be amazing. But yeah, it's just a great way to get together as a community and meet people that are like-minded and friendly, and yeah, and we'll stay kind of aligned with that, and we'll stay going to these events and having an open attitude and being keen to build a community. And yeah, you know, I said earlier the Gold Coast gay scene was cliquey. There's something about the gay scene in Tasmania that I've noticed, which is that it's not cliquey. It's that people come together from all walks of queer life, and there's nowhere near as much ageism or like intersectionality or whatever, that people, regardless of whether you're gay, queer, bi, man, woman, trans, whatever, we're all here together, you know, fighting the good fight.
Yeah,
and that's something so special, and I hope that continues. Yeah,
thank you so much for coming in. And
no worries,
sharing.
Thank you. It was awesome. Good. It felt like a therapy session. It was really nice.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, please take some time to reflect and ensure you reach out for support if you need it. If you are listening in Tasmania, you can contact Working It Out via their website or calling 6231 1200 during business hours. If you need immediate mental health support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to get in touch or share your story on this podcast, please send us an email at nwpride@outlook.com. This podcast is produced by Northwest Pride, a community group based across the north, northwest and west coast of Tasmania. They host events and social inclusion opportunities for anyone who is a part of the LGBTIAQ+ community, their friends and allies. This podcast is made possible by the support of Working It Out. You can hear future episodes and all of our past episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, rate, and review if you can. It does help us to reach more folks who might enjoy or benefit from hearing these amazing life stories. We'll be back soon. Take care of yourself and each other.